housing. We were reciting the Raven in this front table here. There we go. We can. I can read it now for y'all if you like. Read the Raven. You like that, Brian?
Nevermore.
Well, welcome to the Dallas Philosopher Swarm. We're dedicated to bringing philosophy, ideas, and intellectual discussion to an interested audience in the DFW area. I'm Rob Olson. I want to thank everyone for coming out tonight. We meet the second and fourth Tuesday of the month, from September through May.
Yeah,
waiting for Mona. Hi, welcome. Come on in. And we have any first-time visitors? I know we have a microbiologist here. She's a first-time.
Molecular
biologist, pardon me. Yes, yes. How did you hear about us, ma'am?
Friends,
okay.
Yes.
Oh.
And I'm a psychiatrist.
You're a psychiatrist. Oh, what? Well, you're going to have I hope you have some tough questions for our speaker.
And she's French.
That's French from me. I'm from France.
Oh, why? Yes, sir. And your first time, what's your name?
Hi.
Okay, and have you heard about from your friend? And okay, awesome. Well, we're really glad that everyone is here tonight. And I just wanted to, anyone else? Oh, yes. Yes, sir. What's your name?
Richard,
okay.
Richard Cavalier.
Are you a French psychiatrist as well?
Oh, oui.
Oui. Okay. This is really very interesting. Do we have any German psychiatrists, right? Okay, our fall schedule, I just want to mention a couple things coming up. On November 11th, we have Interreligious Dialogue by George James, PhD at UNT, and I had the privilege of visiting with this gentleman, and he's been doing a lot of traveling in India, and so he's very familiar with the Hindu faith and drawing comparisons, the Hindu religion and Christianity, and just this interreligious dialogue, and I think it's going to be a real treat to hear him speak. He's been a professor for many years at UNT. And then yours truly, I'll be speaking on the world in 2034. I'll be talking about trends in nanotechnology, genetics, artificial intelligence, and robotics, and tying those into philosophical implications. I've been speaking on that in risk management groups, so I've had a risk management perspective on that, but I'll be now talking about it in a philosophical and ethical, ethical conundrums involved in that technology. And then on 12/9, we'll be having a talk on happiness, Dr. Theology and PhD from Dallas Baptist University, so that should be really good as well. So tell your friends, if you want a copy of this, come see me afterwards, and we'll get you a copy of it. It's on our website, www.philosophersforum.org. If you haven't paid already, if you could do so right at the lecture, we have a fill-in. Our Vice President, David Drum, is our treasurer tonight. And so if you haven't paid the $5, then please do so after the lecture. If you're a student, and I need any students here tonight? Oh, yes, we have one student here, our molecular biologist from UTD. So if that's $2, and if you want to become a subscriber, the cost is $35 for 6 months. And then every once in a while, someone forgets to pay their bill for their meal and their drinks, and then we have to pay that. We're a non-for-profit, pitifully poor organization. And so please make sure you pay your bill and generously tip the wait staff. They do a tremendous job for us here. And the website, as I mentioned, we already have the information there on our website. There's an FAQ section there. And also, you can go to www.meetup. You can go type in meetup in Dallas Philosopher's Forum, and you can get on the meetup list as well. And if anyone wants to help out, we can always use some volunteers to help out with social media or with AV needs. If you're interested, we would love to have you help us out on that. Our speaker is going to, tonight he'll speak for 45 minutes and open it up to questions. So please turn off your cell phones or silence your cell phones at this time. The Dallas Philosopher's Forum has wanted to have a lecture on dreams for a long, long time. So I contacted Dr. Freud, unavailable. Contacted Dr. Carl Jung, unavailable. I even tried Dr. Phil, no luck. But we found someone even better. We have found someone that is better than all three of those combined. We are very privileged to have Dr. David Alkett with us tonight. He graduated, he has a very impressive resume. Graduated from the University of Texas Southwestern Medical School in Dallas and did his dermatology residency at Temple University Skin and Cancer Hospitals in Philadelphia. He's a clinical professor, dermatology department at Southwestern Medical Center, where he actively teaches dermatologic surgery. He's given numerous lectures, and has published 18 articles and chapters and books. He's an award-winning author, by the way, a wide variety of books that I'll get into that in a minute. He's on the editorial board of Vitality Magazine and regularly appears on radio, TV, and in national magazines as an expert in his field. He was voted number one cosmetic surgeon in Dallas by the Dallas Business Journal. Now, I'm one of his patients, and I'm 98 years old. How about that?
Don't
make
like a day over
80. He also does tummy tucks, you know. Work on my tummy. Little too much of a mission. So he's also the author of Self-Creating Universe, Fatal Philosophy, and I think Fatal Philosophy is what he won. No, it's a Requiem for Athens that he won that award. He'll be speaking this evening on why do we sleep and why do we dream. And now please join me in welcoming Dr. David Alkett.
Is this working?
It should be.
Okay. Can you hear me, everybody?
Talk louder.
Well, you know, we sleep for about a third of our lives. Babies sleep for 20 hours or more a day. Adolescents up to 12. Adults, you know, 7 or 8 hours. If you think about it, doesn't make much sense from a survival point of view, because we're pretty helpless when we're asleep. Humans and animals are at the mercy of enemies, of danger. So it must serve some kind of biologic function. It must be really important that we sleep. Perhaps even more so than eating and drinking. After all, we can go about 30 days without eating. We can go about maybe 2 weeks without drinking, but only 3 or 4 or 5 days without sleeping. So we're finding out more and more about the functions of sleep, about the structure of sleep, and about what parts of the brain are affected while we sleep. Now, the most puzzling aspect of sleep are dreams, or dreaming. Why does the brain generate all this activity, these images, this action while we're asleep, even when most of the brain's activity is decreased? You're at a party, and everybody seems to be having a good time except you, because they're all speaking in a foreign language.
We.
And we. And the person that you're having a conversation with is stepping on your toe, and you're perturbed, so you turn and look across the room, and there's your long-dead grandfather across the room in a black frock coat. And you say, oh, you said you're happy to see him, you're going to go over and talk to him. So on your way, as you turn, go across the room changes. It's now a big ballroom, and all the men are in frock coats, and all the women are in ball gowns, and you're in your pajamas. And you go across the room, and by the time you get to your grandfather, he's changed. He's Abraham Lincoln in his frock coat. And he's glad to see you, and you're glad to see him. You shake hands, and you say, I have an important word to whisper to you, a very important word. And he says, okay. And he bends down, and you whisper this important word, phlegm. All of a sudden, you and Abraham Lincoln zip up into the sky. And you're flying, and you're so happy because you're out over the city and seeing everything, and Abe has disappeared. And all of a sudden, you have this urge to urinate. And it becomes so intense that you wake up. Well, why are dreams so dreamlike? I'm sure you've had dreams that are something like that. In order to get a sense of why we dream, though, we have to begin to look at sleep. Like I said, well, I didn't say, but all animals that we know of sleep. It's an ancient evolutionary biologic mechanism that serves some function. Carnivores sleep. They sleep more than prey animals. The prey animals have to sort of stay awake to keep away from the carnivores that can, the lions, the lion can sleep for 20 hours after a good meal. Fish can sleep with a half a brain, as do dolphins, because they have to breathe in water. Migrating birds can sleep while they're flying. It's even known that worms and fruit flies, Drosophila, sleep. And if fruit flies are kept at a kept stirred up, then they kind of get into a stuporous sleep for a longer period of time. Do animals dream? Well, have you ever seen your dog?
Yeah.
Moaning and yelping and
running,
moving his legs, you know. He's probably dreaming, but we can't ask him. He can't talk to us. Okay, so let's go to the next slide here, if I can make this work.
Duh.
Come on, Ken.
Did it work?
It's been red. Anyway, so what is the structure of sleep? We got that. Stay on the ground.
We get the space out.
Stay on the ground.
You can be a slide person if you like.
I don't know. I'm not sure what the deal is with that.
I'll be a slide person.
Can you do it?
I'll be a slide person.
Yeah.
All right. So what's the structure of sleep? The brain just doesn't turn off for 8 hours and then come back on. EKGs can measure the electrical activity of the brain. And this activity goes from a normal, rapid, but low amplitude while we're awake, this type of thing, to a slower pattern of slow waves, but higher troughs and amplitude that we call a non-REM sleep. This is a slow wave, deeper sleep. Then, at approximately 90-minute intervals, hour and a half or so, the sleeper then goes into this pattern in which the waves become more rapid and shallower again, sort of like the awake, almost like the awake pattern. And during this time, if you notice the sleeper, under their eyelids, their pupils are going back and forth and back and forth as if they're watching a movie. And we call this rapid eye movement, or REM sleep. It's also noted that this slow wave pattern later on during the night becomes even slower, with slower, higher waves, but slower even than the early. And we'll get into the reason for this a little later. So what's happening during sleep? Something that the body or the brain must have to survive. The brain uses almost 20% of the body's energy, total energy, goes to the brain. But this doesn't markedly decrease during sleep. So what's the brain doing? It's doing something. It must be important because this incapacitated animal is powerless. So one theory is that the brain has to clean out the chemical trash. A recent study by Dr. Macon Niedergaard of the University of Rochester showed that the brain has its own waste disposal system called the glymphatic. That's lymphatic with a G. Mm-hmm. This is highly active during sleep. The brain is not connected to the regular lymphatic system. There's this blood-brain barrier. So it has its own waste disposal system. And the researchers found that the brain cells actually decrease in size to make some area for this toxic waste products to be flushed out by the lymphatic system. And this efficient and timely removal of accumulated waste, especially amyloid beta, which is, we think, has something to do with the formation of Alzheimer's and other neurodegenerative diseases. So that's important for this waste disposal system to work. So because of the pumping action of the cerebrospinal fluid and this lymphatic demand, it demands a lot of energy. And the researchers speculate that the brain's got to turn off. It's got to, you know, turn off some activity to let the cleaning take effect. Sort of like when you have a party, you've either got to entertain the guests or clean the house. You can't do both. So we turn off some of these researchers think that some of the activity of the brain has to turn off so that the cleaning can take effect. That's why also the cells are shown to shrink in size about 60% during this time. So that's their theory. Other theories as to why sleep is necessary is to clean out the sensory trash. That is, all the sensory input that we've had during the day, everything that we've seen, heard, tasted, done, talked about during the day, the brain's got to sift through this and decide what's important and what's not. And so we're going to go to the next. We got it going. All right. So these guys, Dr. Giulio Tonini and Chiara Chiarelli at the University of Wisconsin-Madison came up with this theory as to why the neurons in those sleeping brains are almost as active as in the waking state. They are active. So why? Why would the conscious brain turn off, disconnect from the world, the external world, and the brain just keeps on ticking? You know, it's using all this energy. Why? They surmise that the conscious experience of the brain has to be interrupted in order to integrate new memories. And it's got to do this so that it's got to turn off the conscious part, the new input, without becoming oversaturated or obliterating older memories. And their hypothesis is that in order for the brain to return to its baseline for the next day, there has to be some weakening in what it's some of the neural connections, the synapses that are made during sleep, during the day, during the sleep. So while we're awake, they surmise that there are these strong connections here between, this is kind of a schematic here, between these neurons. And these are new ones that have developed during the day, these little orange or gold or brown little connections here. And that as we sleep, the weaker ones, the stronger ones are made stronger, and the weaker ones are deleted. It's shown also because the brain has to distinguish between what's relevant, what's unimportant, and what's noise, and that has to be deleted. And dreams may be a part of this. We may get into some of that. dreams are part of the scenarios that the brain may be going through to decide what's important to keep. So, while the brain is doing it, it has to be disconnected from its sensory input. In other words, we've got to be asleep in order to create new memories in an ideal environment, you know, to integrate and consolidate important things. Their research also showed that in fruit flies and mice, during a day of overstimulation, that they increase certain little spines along the neurons of the synapses, and that with sleep during the night, some of those spines decrease or go away. Now, this they call down selection, in which the brain is selecting, you know, which ones are important to keep, which ones are not. The ones that are kept are either activated strongly during that day from something that you're studying or doing, or something that's important, or something that you're doing consistently during awakening. And because, so they'll be better integrated, better correlated with previous memories also, and they'll be kept. Okay. So they think that this is probably why we notice that decrease in the REM sleep. Let's see if we can, oh gosh.
You gotta aim it at the computer.
Yeah, I know, but it went to green, it went to red. That's wrong. All right, but you saw where it slowed down.
Next slide, did you want the next slide?
Huh?
Are you wanting to go back?
Yeah, that one. No, no, not that one. Yeah, here we go.
You gotta aim it at the
computer. Oh, yeah, you're right.
Trying to go back?
You should do it. Not that one.
There. This here. Early, late. And we think this is because of that filtering out. So if you think about it, it's not important that you remember what you had for breakfast yesterday, or the color of the car that was in front of you at the light. But it is important that you remember new material for your job, or for school, or for a project. So, sleep aids the acquisition of new memories. And many studies have shown that a person can learn new material better if they've had a good night's sleep than if they've been awake all day. So students, take note. Don't stay awake all night studying. Sleep is especially important in childhood and adolescence, because we know that there's an explosive number of new neurons that are manufactured in early childhood and adolescence, and these are because the child is learning, and then these are cut down and deleted later on, as the child or the growing human doesn't need a certain circuit or neurons, and then these are deleted. And that's probably why they sleep a lot. That's why adolescents have to sleep a lot. Okay. So their experiments also led to a concept of what they call local sleep. Because of the plasticity of the brain, a part that is more stimulated during wakefulness would need more sleep. If a part of the brain that is particularly stimulated a lot during the day, then it goes into kind of a stuporous little local sleep, even though the person is aware and awake. So this they call local sleep, and showed that some sleep-deprived humans can do this, and little small chunks of the brain just kind of turn off and take quick naps. So we can wonder, you know, how many errors in judgment, how many silly mistakes, how many irritable moods are caused, you know, in a person who is overtired mentally. And even though they are awake and conscious, part of their brain is asleep. We also notice that stress affects sleep. It's hard to get to sleep if you're under stress. And lack of sleep causes more stress. So it's a kind of a vicious cycle. We also note that stress causes decrease in the amount of glycogen, which is an energy storage mechanism in the brain. And so if you have decreased energy during the brain during while you're awake and you're asleep, the stress causes this vicious cycle also. Also, fragmented sleep, or especially sleep that's fragmented in unpredictable times. This wrecks havoc with the ability of the brain to restore its energy. And we know that prisoners are tortured in this way to break down their will by tortures. The KGB was really excellent at this, awakening people at odd hours and keeping them up, et cetera, et cetera. So, what actually happens in the brain while we sleep? We can use sophisticated brain imaging now, PET scans, MRIs, to see which areas are active and which are inactive. So, overall, there's a decrease in activity of the brain in general. The reticular activating system has to do with, it has input from sensory, from all kinds of areas, and it has to do with your arousal, your awareness, your awareness of your surroundings, etc. It's kind of an internal integrating part. So this kind of is turned off or turned way down. Your alertness, arousal is decreased dramatically, and this makes sense. The motor areas that are in charge of your muscle activities are practically turned off, and that makes more sense too. They're very quiescent. Now, the primary sensory areas, you're not seeing, hearing, you know, smelling, etc. So that sensory input, that's turned off. You're not using those primary sensory areas. The central areas for new memory formation, now, that's turned off. But I just talked about memory, didn't I? This is new memory. You're not making new memories while you're asleep. You are correlating and interrelating all the memories from the day before, okay? But you're not making new memory formation, so that's turned off. Now, what's really interesting is the prefrontal cortex. That's this part of the brain that makes us the most human. It's our seat of consciousness, our judgment, our self-discipline, postponement of gratification, tells us what not to do, that sort of thing. So that's quiescent. That the energy has gone way, way down with that. Why? That's interesting. We'll talk about that. Okay, so some areas, especially during this REM pattern of sleep, are increased in activity, sometimes even more so than when we're awake. After about, you know, 90 minutes of the non-REM, when we go into this. So what's happening at that time? Autonomic function increases, our heart rate, breathing, we breathe deeper and more regular, heart rate may go up, digestion goes up. You get sleepy after a big meal. The limbic system. This is that old lizard part of the brain that's has to do with fear and fright and anger and emotions and that sort of thing. Why would it be turned off? That's interesting. We'll talk about that. But that is turned on and is much more active during the REM sleep. The hippocampus has to do with memory. Now, not the memory, the new memory, but this is where we retrieve our old memory. This is where we've recorded things that are important to us. What happened the day Kennedy died? I mean, something like that, that is really, we put that into our file, and that's the hippocampus. And this can become very active, and that's where our dreams kind of dredge up these old memories, you know, mother and father and grandfather, and when you were in school, and these old memories come from the hippocampus. And this is where we're going to store those important memories that we want to store during the day. That's where we're going to store them. Okay, the associative sensory cortex is where, you see something, you see thing with two eyes and a nose and a mouth and it kind of looks like maybe a face. You see that with your eyes. That's the primary sensory cortex, all right? But then this goes into this area here and it says, aha, these features and this thing, we're going to make that looks like a face. And we're going to compare that with with our memory banks and associate it, and it's going to be a face, okay? So this area kind of takes the sensory input and makes meaning out of it, associates it with memories, and makes it meaningful for the brain. So this is going online, and so that's why your dreaming is just, you know, full of visual imagery. You know, you're seeing all kinds of stuff, hearing, etc. So that's very active. So what's happening? What's happening here? During waking, the frontal cortex is reining in this limbic system during the day. All of a sudden, the frontal cortex has gone offline and this limbic system goes wild. So you're seeing all kinds of fantasies and action, violence, fighting, running. My wife says that I run in my sleep. And one time I actually got into a fight and hit her. And that woke her up and me up. So that's where that comes from. The prefrontal cortex reining in the limbic system during the day, offline at night, the limbic system goes wild. So dreams are dreamlike because of this prefrontal cortex going offline and this limbic system going wild. Okay, let's see. Now that's going to bring up questions. Questions. What's the meaning of the content of the dreams? Don't they mean something? Well, some may be a recapitulation of what's happened during the day. I mean, you've been so active, so intense on, you know, this problem, you kind of dream about it. And sometimes the problem will, you reach a conclusion or a solution to this problem, and sometimes people will wake up and jot it down. And if they don't jot it down, they kind of forget it, or it goes away. So this is maybe what we're trying to understand when this happens during our REM sleep. Some people even wake up and write down, yeah, I said, okay. Sometimes they're disguised messages. Sometimes insights, you know, like, oh yeah, the brain starts to correlate, you know, what happened during the day is trying to make new correlations, okay, and then all of a sudden, there's this, oh, yeah, And you may get an image of it or kind of a strange message, you know, disguised in your dream. So there's a whole science or pseudoscience of interpreting dreams in the Bible. Joseph, you know, with his dream interpretations for Pharaoh, and and Daniel with his interpretation. Freud wrote a whole book on the interpretation of dreams, psychosexual meanings, etc. Why do some people dream more than others? Or have vivid dreams? Some have more vivid dreams than others. What's the significance of different dream content? I want to ask something. How many people dreamed last night?
Everybody here, unless you're an alcoholic.
Okay. Now, of you, how many people remember their dreams? Okay. Now, do you remember them well enough to recount them?
Yeah.
Not as many. You see, that's that memory part. You had the dream, but if you don't, if it's not, you know, just near when you're going to wake up and you and it's really emotionally triggered, you know, invested with some emotional content, you're not going to remember it.
I was doing a dual presentation with Barack Obama last night.
You were. Very good. That's pretty emotional.
Don't know where that came from.
Okay, why are there individual differences? Some of you remembered, some of you didn't. Some people, we were discussing dream and technicolor, vivid technicolor, some, you know, black and white. Why does the limbic system run wild during dreams? I have an idea about that. I was just thinking about that. Why would the prefrontal cortex turn off? Animals, we don't believe, have a prefrontal cortex. They don't have, you know, consciousness and, you know, that sort of thing. But they do have a limbic system. And when they're asleep, that limbic system is probably running. They're not worried about their prefrontal cortex. Okay, is there a relationship between how much the frontal cortex turns off and how vivid dreams are? We don't know. How much is there an inverse relationship between how active the frontal cortex is during the day, how much conscious activity we're doing, how is there an inverse relationship that it turns off even more so, and then we have more vivid dreams because of that? We don't know that either. So these and other questions await, you guessed it, more research. Isn't that true with most scientists? Okay, since this is a philosophical as well as a scientific group, I suppose there are philosophical questions, why not, about sleep and dreaming, especially maybe the mythical or spiritual in a broad sense of the term, sense or a psychological meaning for dreaming, Freud, etc. But I'm not going to get into that. I'm going to let that go for discussion. So it's open.
Okay, any questions?
I don't think anybody knows the answer to this question. But why is it that we repeat dreams over and over and over again over a period of years?
Well, some dreams we do repeat over and over again because we haven't that's a problem that we haven't solved in our life, perhaps, and it's come back, you know, to present us with that problem. We talked about very, very common dreams that most all of us have when we're students. I had a course. I've got a course somewhere, and I don't know where to get, where it is, or where it's scheduled, or how to get to that course, or an exam that I've got to take, and I don't know where to go to that exam. That's a very, very common dream that we almost all have. So that's kind of a recurring dream that people have even after they're out of school. Another very common dream is that you're naked.
Never.
You never? Oh, I've had that dream a lot. You're naked out in public somewhere, and that's been explained to me that it means that you're vulnerable. You're very vulnerable. And people don't seem to bother that you're naked. You're just trying to go out there naked.
It's like they're not aware of it, right?
Yeah.
Because I've had that dream too.
Yeah, they're not aware of it.
If you had someone that had a bilateral hippocampus removal, such as the famous neurological patient, HM, yeah. Who went for 40 years with no short-term memory at all, he could remember in the cortex for 30 seconds, and that was it.
Right.
And he could tell you things that happened years ago, but nothing that happened 10 minutes ago.
Right.
Would that person need less sleep?
I don't know about their sleep. We do know about these people that lose their long-term memory or short-term memory. You know, we have different kinds of memory. We may not remember the person that we were introduced to, but we don't forget how to ride a bicycle. I mean, that long-term memory, that's get on a bicycle at any age. I mean, you know, and you can ride. But short-term memory is different, yeah.
Question back to your head.
Are there identified hemispheric effects, left side, right side effects?
Not that I know of. I think it's kind of ubiquitous. It's all over.
This is regarding number 4 there. Why do mood-altering drugs produce such vivid dreams?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Mood-altering drugs, why do they produce such vivid dreams?
Why do
mood-altering drugs?
Mood-altering drugs.
After personal experience?
I think it turns off that prefrontal cortex. you know, when you're in a drunken stupor, you see all kinds of hallucinations. Yeah.
I think one thing that's interesting, if you think about dreaming as, think about the fact that sleep is necessary, then you can think about dreams being something that preserves sleep. It seems that that gives some meaning to the dream, that if the dream is preserving your sleep, then it's like a movie kind of distracting you from waking up. You know, like if you hear a truck outside your window and you dream that you're driving a truck, the dream distracts you from actually waking up, and it seems like I've heard some kind of theory that the content of the dream is unique to us because that's the movie or the distraction that we need to preserve our sleep. That makes sense.
Well, the deep sleep is there. This is where we're in our deeper sleep. The REM sleep, where we're dreaming, that brain is active there. But this slow wave motion, that's when we're in our deeper sleep.
Yeah, I'm interested in sort of these theories about what's going on. And it would be interesting to know if sleep is just to clean out the waste products. This could only take a finite amount of time. Now, what sort of sleep does a person have an animal have when it's hibernating, for instance, or a person in a deep coma? Is there an initial phase rather like this, and then it settles into something else? Does anybody know?
I haven't seen that study. I don't know. I don't know what happens to bears when they hibernate.
Yeah.
Probably, part of their brain is asleep, and part of it's not, obviously. Just like fish.
Psychologically speaking,
what's the meaning, in your opinion, of flying when you fly or float in your sleep, in your dream, excuse me, dream of floating and flying?
You obviously have an answer for that.
I always have answers to questions I ask. I do, but I was curious.
No, I don't. Okay.
Well,
I'm
a dream. You're not a dream interpreter.
No, I'm not an interpreter. Yeah, but, you know, I've read some, but...
You don't have your...
You know, I remember dating this girl in college, and she was telling me that she had this dream about this big snake that wrapped around her leg and came up her leg, and I said, you need to go read Freud's interpretation of dreams. I wasn't going to get into that.
What is your answer for flying?
I'll tell you later.
You don't want to tell us now?
Well, I think flying or floating in your dreams is indicative of a desire or reality of excelling and being above other people.
What about the desire to become free? Like you're trapped in a job or in a relationship and you have this desire to become for freedom.
I think that's possible as well. I don't know if this idea is taken seriously anymore or if it ever was. I think it was in the Carl Sagan book from the 70s or something, where he talked about sort of an evolutionary reason for sleep. Might have been the idea that some animals, for lack of a better term, are too stupid to stop moving, particularly at night when there's prey, or when they're more likely to be prey. So the idea was sleep would evolve so that they would sort of be stationary at the hours when their predators were most active. And I think I remember that, you might know this, ocean animals sleep less than land animals. I don't know if that's true, but I think the idea was there's fewer places to hide in the ocean, so maybe they didn't need to evolve that.
We know now a lot more than we did in the 70s about, you know, neurobiology, neurophysiology, PET scans and MRIs and, you know, what's happening basically biologically, you know, in the brain than they did then. And so we now have a more scientific basis of why sleep is necessary. You know, I gave you two theories, and there are probably, you know, some more also. As far as fish have no eyelids, so they don't close them. And if you see a fish, if you've ever had a fish tank, sometimes you just see the fish sort of floating there. You know, it's not doing anything. It's just kind of floating there. It's probably asleep.
So every once in a while, people will say, or someone will say, that I don't dream. And isn't it that that's probably not the case, they just don't remember their dreams, is that right?
I think that's right.
And so, because so dreaming is essential for life, and that's one of the theories as far as why Michael Jackson died, is that he had this artificial sleep through that medication that he was on. Propofol or something. And so, one of the theories was that he died because he wasn't getting sleep.
It's commonly noted that even though when you drink alcohol, that you may go to sleep, but you don't sleep well, and that as the alcohol kind of wears off, you become stimulated and you kind of wake up. So you don't get good restful sleep, even though you know you're maybe in a drunken haze. It's not good sleep. Yes.
So you were talking about. You used to dream that you were naked in the street.
Do what?
You used to dream that you were naked in the street.
Yes, naked, yes.
Okay, I didn't have quite a dream, but I often dreamed when I was a child that my skirt fell off. In fact, I felt so ashamed
You were ashamed?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And then self-conscious, the next day if I went somewhere, I made sure.
Yeah, right. So you remember that. Did you have that dream more than once?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
I remember.
That means something, right?
It does mean something.
I remember my first dream, and that's kind of strange because we did not have television in France at that time. I was not listening to any radio. I didn't even walk. And I remember being in bed, and there was this great big man with a huge knife at the end of my bed. And I was so scared. I know I didn't walk because I crawled to my mother's bed.
Yeah.
So, very interesting. Now, my husband is different. You see, what you see is what you get. He looks very gentle, very nice, and he is. He really is. But I tell you what, when he goes to bed, oh my!
He's active?
Oh yes, the first time I realized how active he was, about 2 or 3 in the morning I hear, and I said, Richard, what are you doing? He said, I'm feeding the chicken. And then, you know, the next time he moved in my back and I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm steering my submarine. And then he beat me. Like somebody said that their husband beat them. He beat me. My arm was black and blue.
I want to ask another question of the group. How many, after they've seen a particularly violent movie, a lot of explosions and murders and mayhem and war and whatever, will have that type of dream, an action dream at night?
Only if I
don't have to
really say, right before I go to bed,
kind of relive
I will
it.
Not do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead. You have a question.
What do you have to say about childhood sleepwalking? And do you have anything to say? I used to sleepwalk a lot when I was a kid. I also used to dream that I flew a lot. Don't dream that much anymore.
Puke states, what? Can you help me on that, Paul?
Sleepwalking.
Somnambulism, it's called.
Yeah, and most children I hear grow out, but I did, thank God. But I, and my sister, same thing. But you don't have anything to say about that. Okay.
Well, the parts of the brain that are supposed to turn off didn't turn off.
It didn't turn off his motor system.
I've noticed that we find a great pleasure in talking about our dreams. I'm not sure if you share my opinion, but why we find a pleasure in talking about our dreams, describing them, and trying to hold them other people?
For what? For psychological reasoning?
Yeah. Not only for psychological, but yeah.
It can be also psychological reason, more the question why, what, but maybe there's a biological explanation or maybe psychological explanation to this, why we share so eagerly our dreams.
Why we like to share them?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Emotional content?
There's got to be emotional content.
Is this our social nature that we like to share things?
No, because there's great mysteries.
I got a question about timing. Like with the chart that you have up there, suppose in the middle of the night you're interrupted by something like a bathroom call.
Yeah.
When you come back, do you go back, does that cycle start over again, or do you just go back into the period of it that you left it in?
We were kind of discussing that a little bit before, that, and this is a phenomenon that's kind of noted, that if you're dreaming kind of near awakening, maybe you get up, go to the bathroom, or you're kind of in a twilight, almost awakening, that you can finish your dream, or even finish it to a good conclusion. You know, like you're running away from somebody, then you can, you know, become safe. So you can almost make your dreams some semi-conscious. You kind of finish your dream in a semi-conscious state. Yeah.
A fair number of adolescents experience something called night terrors, which are, as I understand it, different than normal dreams because they're very vocal, they scream, they thrash around, they're active, and extremely hard to wake up, and I just wonder if physiologically
they're different.
That's that limbic system, and there's hormones that are just going wild. I don't have any other explanation for that. David?
I've never experienced it personally, but some people talk about the phenomenon of lucid dreaming, where you're aware that you're dreaming. So
yes,
you hear talk
yes,
about that?
Yes, yes, we were talking about that. Or that, well, what I just said, kind of finishing a dream, kind of a semi-lucid. And maybe that's that, you know, you, when you're kind of local sleep, you part of your brain's, a, you know, offline, you're semi-asleep. Maybe that has something to do with that.
Along those lines, I have discovered that I can change my dream if I don't like it. Mm-hmm. If I'm in a dream, yeah, usually it's in the early morning when I'm close to waking up.
Yes.
Now I'm in a dream that things are happening that I don't like.
Yes.
I can tell myself, I don't like this. Yes. I'm going to change my dream, and I do change it. I don't understand the
process,
but I can do it. It happens.
Yeah, that's what I just said a while ago about changing there.
I'm offering it.
Oh, okay.
Couldn't you consider dreams as a kind of check valve? Like if you have a lot of emotion going on, you know, during the day, that at night your brain would kind of just release a lot of emotion and it just comes out in dreams?
I think so. I think especially if you've done something intense during the day and we don't know how much that prefrontal cortex turns off because of, you know, how intense it was. But yes, if you've done something intense during the day, you kind of recapitulate it. You're putting that important stuff into memory. So it maybe dreams has something to do with that too.
I found that we can train ourselves to remember our dreams. When we dream, we can pause for a short time and say, I will remember that in the morning. And I do.
Okay.
Now you were making reference to Daniel in the Bible.
I don't know.
Well, yes, you do.
Oh, I didn't understand.
Daniel in the Bible, dreams, yes.
Daniel? Damien.
Daniel.
Daniel, yes. Daniel in the lion's den, yes.
Yeah.
And Nebuchadnezzar's dream, yes.
What do you think of those dreams?
Meeni, meeni, tikkun laparsin. That's what he said. That was the handwriting on the wall.
That was
meeni, meeni, tikkun laparsin.
Do you think people just made that up?
No, I didn't make it up. That's what.
No, not you.
Oh, did Daniel make it up? I don't know.
No, not Daniel. Generally, do you believe that Daniel had those dreams and they happened the way he says?
Well, you know, don't get me into the Bible, please. That's a very controversial subject.
Oh, no. Not unless we want it to be.
Okay, we have time for one more question.
I just wanted to ask about emotion versus something more like thought or participating in the panorama, the scene that's evolving. Do strong emotions come from the same part of the brain that, say, we would be using if we were watching a movie or watching something happen to us? Because I don't get the sense that I'm in control of what's happening, and if I am, I can't determine that.
You mean during dreaming?
During a dream. I just move from one scene to the next.
Yeah.
But at times I feel a certain strong emotional feeling.
That's the limbic system.
Oh, that's... Okay. That's
where your emotions come from.
Okay. Thank you. Last question.
You mentioned sleep functioning in memory allocation before.
It's louder.
You mentioned sleep functioning for memory allocation before.
Yes.
Do you think there's a correlation between eidetic memory and sugar sleep signals?
Would you say that again?
Do you think there's a correlation between eidetic memory and shorter sleep signals?
Eidetic. What's eidetic memory?
Almost.
Perfect memory.
Perfect memory.
Short-term memory?
I didn't know.
No, long-term. Like, they can remember everything down to the day, down to the second. For a given year. It's a very small portion of the population.
Oh, versus what now?
Photographic.
Oh, photographic memory and what?
Dreams. And shorter sleep signals.
I don't know. I don't know.
Very simple question.
We want to thank Dr. Elkett for his presentation.